Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from John Russell, Phil Dierking, and Anna Mateo. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
A new study suggests that dark markings on the planet Mars represent sand, not water. Research in 2015 had suggested that lines on some Martian hills were evidence of water. Yet American scientists now say these lines appear more like dry, steep flows of sand. If water is present, they said, it is likely to be a small amount. Water in liquid form would be necessary for microbial life. NASA, the American Space Agency, said more research is needed. Michael Meyer is the lead scientist for NASA's Mars Exploration Program. He noted that the latest study does not reject the presence of water. But, he admitted, it just may not be as exciting as the idea of rivers going down the sides of cliffs. NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter provided the images of dark lines. Thousands have been reported on the Red Planet. The new findings come from a team led by Colin Dundas of the United States Geological Survey in Flagstaff, Arizona. His team measured 151 of these lines in 10 areas. Most of the lines end with slopes between 28 degrees and 35 degrees. These measurements are similar to active sand dunes on both Mars and Earth, the researchers noted. They said a small covering of dust that moves and sometimes becomes lighter might help explain the markings. They usually appear in the Martian summertime, then disappear until the next year. If these lines are dry, this suggests that recent Mars has not had considerable volumes of liquid water, the researchers wrote. Dundas and his research team say that many questions remain. To Meyer, the large number of questions is what makes Mars so fun. Scientists have long changed their thinking about the planet depending on the findings of the most recent studies. I still think that Mars poses a great potential for having had life early on in its history, Meyer said. As long as that's true, we also have a reasonable possibility of life still being on Mars. It just happens to be cryptic or well hidden. NASA currently has no robotic vehicle, either on Mars or in development, with the ability to climb steep slopes. The lack of such equipment has engineers coming up with ideas like Martian helicopters or drones. But going from a clever idea that works in your sandbox to something that goes to Mars takes a fair amount of engineering development, Meyer said. I'm John Russell.
Yvonne Kavia is an 18-year-old high school student in Rwanda. She wants to become a chemical engineer. She enjoys doing experiments and taking careful notes in her high school laboratory in Kigali, Rwanda's capital city. Kavya's interest in science is important to her, but it is also part of a larger goal for the Rwandan government to prepare more girls for science and technology-related careers. The hope is to also create a model for other African governments to follow. Many girls in Kavya's class are also interested in careers in science and technology. Keza Marie Eme is one of them. She plans to become a pilot. Her backup plan is to be a pharmacist, she says.
The first thing which came into my mind before choosing this course that I wanted to live with girls, who know what they want. The reason I want to become the pilot is that we're having few girls who are pilots, and I want to show people that, yes, we can as girls.
Aimé and Kavya both attend the Fawe Girls' School. It is one of many STEM-centered schools in Rwanda that have opened in the past 10 years. STEM is an education program that specializes in learning science, technology, engineering, and math. Fawe is considered one of the country's best STEM schools. The boarding school admits girls from poor families. On national exams, the Fawe students often score in the top percentile. Pascal Dukuzi is a chemistry teacher at Fawe Girls' School. He says it is important to encourage girls to study STEM fields.
Believing that they have that potential of doing sciences as well as boys, I think it's very good for them, because with sciences, one can do many things.
The Rwandan Ministry of Education reports that the number of girls studying STEM in school is on the rise. The number of girls in secondary schools taking science classes grew from 48.7% in 2011 to over 55% in 2015. This is all part of the Rwandan government's plan to transform the economy by 2020. It hopes to do this, in part, by increasing the number of people with careers in STEM fields. The World Bank says Rwanda is one of a small number of African countries leading the way in expanding STEM education. A 2017 report that measured the ability of African governments to develop science and technology fields placed Rwanda third, behind Morocco and Tanzania. The report said Rwanda's efforts to expand STEM education include establishing a science ministry, creating research programs, partnering with private groups, and awarding scholarships. The Ministry of Education's budget increased nearly 10% from last year. 14% of its $280 million budget is for STEM projects. This includes developing smart classrooms with computers and internet connectivity and building a center for theoretical physics. The Rwandan government wants to double the current budget for STEM education at the university level. Jeanette Gahunga graduated from university 3 years ago with a degree in computer programming. Now, she is a volunteer teacher at a public primary school in Kigali. She teaches her students how to create interactive animations using a free programming software called Scratch. Half of the students in her class are girls. Gahunga says she tries to support them because mentorship is important to keeping girls on the STEM track. I'm Phil Dierking.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. It is one of the worst things a parent can imagine. Your child is sick and suffering in terrible pain. No medical treatments seem to help. That was the condition of a 9-year-old boy with an incurable skin disease. The father says his son was near death.
He was in severe pain and asking a lot of questions I could not answer. Why do I suffer from this disease? Why do I have to live this life?
Today, the boy is no longer suffering like that. In fact, he is healthy and said to be living a normal life. His recovery shows what gene therapy can do. This boy, whose parents do not want him identified, had until recently been suffering from a rare genetic skin condition. The disease is called junctional epidermolysis bullosa. It causes painful wounds and blisters all over the body. The skin is so fragile that it tears and damages easily. The child's doctors in Germany said that none of their treatments was working. Left with no other choice, they said they simply wanted to ease the child's pain and suffering as much as possible. However, the boy's parents did not accept that. They begged the doctors to look for experimental treatments. One of the German doctors is Tobias Rothhuft at Ruhr University in Germany.
So then we thought we could do nothing for this kid and opted for a palliative care approach. We discussed it with the family and they begged us to do something about it or to try anything we could.
The boy's father researched gene therapy on the internet. He told the doctors about his findings. They had never dealt with genetic therapy. The parents urged the doctors to consider the experimental treatment. When the doctors saw that experiments were being carried out, they reached out to another medical expert.
And then we got in contact with Professor Luca. And we discussed this case, and he offered us to give us skin to cover the whole body of this kid.
Michel DeLuca works with the Center for Regenerative Medicine in Modena, Italy. DeLuca says the German doctors tried everything they could to help the boy, but the doctors had few real choices. The German doctors asked DeLuca if he and his team could try the genetic treatment on the patient. They called it an act of compassion. DeLuca explained gene therapy was still experimental. However, he agreed to try it as a treatment of last resort for the boy. DeLuca's team used a virus to put a healthy gene into cells taken from the boy's skin. Some of those cells can multiply indefinitely. So DeLuca was able to grow new, healthy skin for the boy, which he then sent to doctors in Germany. The German doctors used this genetically engineered skin to replace most of the skin on the child's body. DeLuca says the child appeared better in October, after the first transplant on the four limbs. The second operation was on his back and was a bigger transplant. This is when doctors saw that the regeneration or restoration of the skin did something to the boy. He got better right away. The child's vital signs, such as body temperature and blood pressure, began getting better. That is when the doctors realized that the operation was a success. Again, here is one of the boy's German doctors, Tobias Rothhoft.
We're happy that it worked. This kid is back to his normal life again. That's what we dreamed of doing, and it was possible.
2 years later, the boy is now back in school and no longer takes special medication. However, his doctors will have to watch him closely over time to watch for skin cancer or other problems. For the Health and Lifestyle Report, I'm Anna Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we continue our story of the United States Constitution. In recent weeks, we discussed how the Constitution was written. In the summer of 1787, a group of delegates gathered for a convention in Philadelphia. Their plan was to rewrite the Articles of Confederation. Those articles created a weak union of the 13 states. Instead of rewriting the articles, however, they spent that summer writing a completely new plan of government. On September 17th, after 4 months of often bitter debate, the delegates finally agreed to the new plan. Now they had to get at least 9 of the 13 states to approve it. Delegates to the Philadelphia Convention had met in secret. They wanted to be able to debate proposals and change their minds without worrying about public reaction. Now they were free to speak openly. Each had a copy of the new Constitution. Newspapers also had copies. They published every word. Public reaction was great indeed. Arguments for and against were the same as those voiced by delegates to the convention. The Constitution would save the United States. The Constitution would create a dictator. Yale Law School professor Akhil Reed Amar says the public debate about the Constitution was one of its first successes as a democratic document. He notes that even democracies of long ago, like those in Greece or Italy, did not let citizens vote on their constitutions.
People could be for the Constitution or against it. No one was shut down. No one was put in prison if they liked George Washington or they didn't like George Washington. Just this proliferation, robust, wide open, uninhibited discourse up and down a continent.
Supporters of the new Constitution understood that to win ratification, they needed to speak out. So a few weeks after the document was signed, they began writing statements in support of the proposed Constitution. Their statements appeared first in newspapers in New York. They were called the Federalist Papers. They were published under the name of Publius, but they were really written by three men, Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas says he deeply respects the men who wrote the Federalist Papers.
These are people who were engaged, who knew the Constitution. Also want you to know, these were not scholars. These were farmers. These were business people. Some of them who had formal education. Some who did not, but they cared about this country.
Years later, historians said the Federalist Papers were the greatest explanation of the Constitution ever written. But in 1787, they had little effect on public opinion. The debate over the Constitution divided Americans into two groups. Those who supported it were known as Federalists. Those who opposed it were known as Anti-Federalists. The Anti-Federalists were not anti-American. They were governors, heroes of the Revolutionary War, and even a future president. Yet they distrusted the idea of a strong central government. Give too much power to the president, Congress, and the courts, they said, and citizens would no longer be free. They would lose the liberties gained in the war for independence from Britain. Law professor Akhil Reed Amar says the Anti-Federalists were an important part of the debate and of history.
The people who oppose the Constitution, who think it could be better still, they're not cast out. They become presidents of the United States, vice presidents of the United States, justices on the Supreme Court. It's extraordinary how they're kept in the process.
There were both Federalists and Anti-Federalists in the Continental Congress. The Congress had few powers, but it was the only central government the 13 states had at that time. It met in New York City. The convention in Philadelphia had sent the Continental Congress a copy of the new Constitution. Within 8 days, the Congress agreed that each state should organize a convention to discuss ratification. One by one, the states held those meetings. Delaware was the first state to ratify early in December 1787. All the delegates voted to approve it. Pennsylvania was the next to ratify, also in December. New Jersey ratified the Constitution in December, followed by Georgia and Connecticut in January. That made 5 states. The Federalists needed just 4 more to win ratification. Massachusetts voted in early February. Delegates to the state convention wanted the Constitution amended to include guarantees to protect citizens' rights. They agreed to ratify if these guarantees were added later. Maryland ratified the Constitution at the end of April. There, a number of delegates included a letter of protest with their vote. They said, if the plan of government were not amended, the liberty and happiness of the people would be threatened. At the end of May, South Carolina became the 8th state to ratify. Just 1 more state, and the new Constitution would become the law of the land. All eyes turned to Virginia. Virginia was the biggest of the 13 states. 1/5 of all the people in America lived in Virginia. The men who attended the ratifying convention were among the most famous names in the nation: James Madison, Patrick Henry, George Mason, James Monroe, Edmund Randolph, and John Marshall. The most famous Virginian, George Washington, stayed at his home, Mount Vernon. All during the month of June, however, riders brought him messages from the convention and carried messages back. Thomas Jefferson was still in Paris, serving as America's representative to France. But others kept him informed of everything that happened at home. Jefferson wrote back that he liked most of the Constitution, but he said, I do not like the fact that it does not contain a declaration of the rights of citizens. For 3 weeks, the Virginia delegates argued about the Constitution. By the end of June, they were ready to vote. Patrick Henry, the outspoken anti-federalist, asked to make a final statement. "If this convention approves the Constitution," Henry said, "I will feel that I fought for good reasons and lost the fight. If this happens, I will wait and hope. I will hope that the spirit of the American Revolution is not lost. I will hope that this new plan of government is changed to protect the safety, the liberty, and the happiness of the American people." Then the convention voted. Virginia approved the Constitution. However, like Massachusetts, it added that the document must include a Declaration of Rights for the nation's people. Federalists in Virginia thought their state was the ninth to ratify, the one that made the Constitution the law of the land. But they soon learned that New Hampshire had ratified a few days earlier. Virginia was number 10. That left three states: North Carolina, Rhode Island, and New York. In a way, New York was the most important of all. If New York refused to join the Union under the Constitution, it would be almost impossible for a central government to rule the nation. The 12 other states would be divided in two, geographically separated by New York State. Alexander Hamilton was a leader of the Federalists. They used their right to filibuster to make many long speeches to delay the vote. They wanted to wait to hear what Virginia would do. Early in July, they got the news. But New York's anti-Federalists kept up the fight for three more weeks. It was not until the end of July that New York finally ratified the Constitution. The vote was extremely close, 30-27. Like Massachusetts and Virginia, New York demanded a Declaration of Rights. The long struggle to give the United States a strong central government was over. It took 4 months to write a new constitution. It took 10 months to ratify it. Yale Law School professor Akhil Reed Amar says adopting the Constitution was, in his words, the most democratic deed in history.
For the first time ever in the history of the planet, an entire continent got to vote on how they and their posterity would be governed. And there were lots of exclusions, you know, from our perspective, but we wouldn't exist, you know, as a democratic country, as a democratic world, but for that.
The Continental Congress declared that the Constitution would become effective the first Wednesday in March, 1789. The last two states, North Carolina and Rhode Island, did not approve it until many months after that date. Benjamin Rush of Pennsylvania, who had signed the Declaration of Independence, wrote down 8 words when he heard that the Constitution had been ratified. "It is done," he said. "We have become a nation." But before that, the nation's founders had one more question to answer. How would the Constitution guarantee citizens' rights? Delegates at the convention had raised the point many times, and several states made protecting citizens' rights a condition for approving the document.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.